Good evening. Welcome to the Celeri Report. Today is April 16, 2015. I'm Catherine Alston-Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Our theme tonight is the business of the world, and what a back and forth we're watching all over the world. The vast majority of the people in the world understand how important it is to use our time and money to do something useful, to be productive, and there was stark relief over the last month as our allies ignored American threats and moved to join the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, being organized by China. Applications for members accelerated when China agreed to remove their veto, as we discussed last week. But the result is U.S. is beginning to look like the global bully who nearly stops things and has no plan or proposal as to how to take care of the business that needs doing. Part of the problem is the continued U.S. global ambitions are being checked everywhere you turn by domestic devastation wrought on the U.S. population, by wars, particularly as a result of the financial coup d'etat and wars in the Middle East. So this week there was much hand-wringing and name-calling at the policy level as various interested parties debated what could be done. The clear message coming back both domestically and internationally to the U.S. leadership is that, you know, we need something other than being able to rig things with government mandates and force. There's a rising tide of voices who are delivering the message, and basically what they're saying is if we want to eat, we need to grow food, so do something useful or go away. The strategic toolkit that the U.S. had to strong-arm people was to raise interest rates and run the U.S. dollar bear trap, as we've discussed many times in the Celeri Report. The problem is one Fed governor said recently, that growth is disappointed to the downside. What that means is that's going to punch the U.S. economy just as hard as the rest, and so not good for corporate earnings. Frankly, globally and domestically, we're all sick of the neocons and the oligarchs who back them and the toadies that serve them. We're sick of having to pay their bills and clean up their messes. And it's no doubt part of the backdrop that has allowed John Kerry and the administration the leeway to proceed to make, or certainly to try and make, deals with Iran and Cuba. Unfortunately, it's also brought a new push on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think that there's some real fear coming from everything I'm describing. The U.S. Senate agreed today to fast-track the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The leadership agreed to give that authority, and we'll see what the rest of the Congress does. And that could have far-reaching repercussions for both domestic and international politics. Senate leaders said they agreed to the deal after they would aid, or they agreed to a package to aid workers that would be hurt by the deal. I'll believe it when I see it. I don't believe it will ever happen. Anyway, they didn't dare announce that before April 15th. Yesterday was the day that individual taxes are due. The tax date has people seething, and to have announced that while they were still mailing in their checks was not going to work. So my guess is they reached the deal earlier but didn't dare say anything until April 16th. If they don't push it this year, then it's going to be much harder to do next year. It wouldn't surprise me if it's one of the reasons that Reid has announced he's not running for re-election, to get out of the way of the trade bill scrambling down on every control file of every senator and congressman. This is going to get rough. The reality is the G7 financial interests care first and foremost about winning on the global stage, and right now they're playing defense. There's symptoms of fear everywhere, and the fear in the leadership must be significant despite the hubris that they're evidencing. Just to give you a little note, for the last 4 weeks, we've been under constant hack attacks and have numerous other independent news. I'm getting reports from all different sections of the independent news are experiencing the same thing. If you come into the site and it's down, we've gotten very good at bringing back up quickly, but we're going to continue to have these kind of things. As I said, we're moving to new servers just to kind of deal with this. But the reality is that the independent news is getting a growing market share, and we're competing against corporate media that doesn't fight. They fight dirty. And the reality is they can hire some of the best hackers in the emerging markets For $5 an hour, and it costs us much, much more per hour to defend against it. And of course, that's a way of just draining off our profits. But that's the nature of competition and telling the truth of America in the 21st century, and we intend to be very good at it. So we thank you for your patience. But it gives a little sort of sign of the tensions of the time. Money and markets. I wrote a commentary up on the website this week, Before You Bet the Ranch on the End of the World, through this. And I published a chart that came from the J.P. Morgan Chase shareholders letter in their annual report. It was something called Global Macro Themes. And they basically project a doubling in the world economy. So the world gross GDP, they say, will go from 78 trillion to 133 trillion by 2024. So that's about a 5.5% growth. World experts, they expect to go from 22 trillion to 38 trillion a year in 2024. Investable assets, they expect to go from 263 trillion to 481 trillion. Very strong growth in securitized assets. Infrastructure spending, they said, was 36 trillion over the last 18 years. They think it's going to be 57 trillion over the next 18 years. And the number of companies with over $1 billion of revenue is currently 8,000. They predict it's going to be 15,000 in 2024. And what's very interesting is they're painting a picture that's very similar to what we said in the annual wrap-up. So, it's when J.P. Morgan Chase and the Solaria Report agree, it's sort of an interesting alignment, because obviously we're not aligned about much, but it's clear we both have similar expectations of where this thing is going. On one of the critical areas of investment, there's more and more about food and agriculture, and I put up some more links this week. As I said last week, the Chinese Wealth Fund has been talking about investing a lot more in food and agriculture. We see U.S. companies in the food business really struggling to keep up with the fresh and organic demand. Consumers are clearly making it abundantly clear that they want non-GMO, they want fresh, they want organic or natural methods. And we're now seeing food companies literally going out and buying farms, and sovereign wealth funds literally going out and buying farms, because it's the only way they can lock up the supply. The other story I posted this week was from March about sovereign wealth funds. And it points out many of the direct investments that are happening in agriculture. One of the examples was the Qatar Investment Authority. Let me just read some of this. Qatar depends on imports for more than 95% of its food products, and seven countries supply 75% of Qatar's food imports. Across the board, you're seeing countries want to diversify supply. And of course, as you watch what happened to Europe and Russia with the food sanctions on food and the pushback by Russia on the European food market, you can see why people want to improve and diversify supply. Anyway, the Qatar Investment Authority is seeking to hedge the state against possible food price increases. Not just a matter of supply, it's a matter of price as well. And of course, we know that one of the biggest problems that can happen to a leadership is food riots, which has been happening around the world. In 2008, the Qatar Investment Authority bought a local food partner from its parents and financed with $1 billion to invest in agricultural companies around the world. But a good example, in 2008, I tried to build a portfolio of food and agriculture-related stocks, and just really struggled and ultimately had to give up. But if you look at what's evolved since then, there are more and more alternatives. There are more coming into the market. Don't be surprised if food and food-related companies become more and more important. And if you manage your own investments, you want to keep an eye on that sector, because I think it's going to be interesting. Another commentary I wrote was China Blossoms. I talked last week about, literally last Wednesday, the Chinese market went on a moonshot. But it has continued this week. It has continued to hold and rising a little bit, including today. And as I've said before, the U.S. market for several years has diverged strongly ahead of the Asian and European and emerging markets. But so far for the quarter, we're seeing a pretty dramatic turn the other way. So let's just quick look at a roundup of the market. For the year to date, one of the leaders is China's small caps, up 30%, large caps up 25%, Germany now up 23%, India up 10%, emerging markets up 10%, the developed world minus North America up 10%, the S&P at 2.25%, so clearly lagging. Now, of course, it's been way ahead for many years now, and so to a certain extent, this is just catch up. One of the things that has the S&P struggling is, of course, corporate profits, which have been on the steroids of buybacks for many years. And it wouldn't surprise me if part of what's happening on the Trans-Pacific Partnership is real pressure politically to do things that gin up corporate earnings. I'll be talking in the first quarter wrap-up about the pressure for more privatization, which is clearly going to come with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Gold almost flat, now up 1.3% for the year. Oil is still down. It was down 25% mid-March. Now it's only down 3.75%. So if you bought at the bottom, you're doing reasonably nicely. Fixed income is sort of much less exciting than it was at the beginning of the year. The 20-plus year Treasury ETF now up 3%, and the bond aggregate ETF up 1.3%. So the clear message so far for the first 3 months and 2 weeks of the year is it's an equity market. If you look at how the markets have started the first 14 weeks, it's not matching up with the official story predicted expected. So again, that's why we see the leadership scramble going on. We have G7 and Bilderberger in June, Bohemian Grove in July. There's a lot of posturing of the leadership to try and pitch the assembled mob at those meetings. Again, I think they're making the decisions, not the voters. And in that spirit, we have our new Solari tune up on the bubble. I'd written a commentary called The Hubris Bubble about the outrageous posting that Larry Summers did, his sort of pitch to look good in front of the folks at G7, Bilderberger and the Grove. And so we did a little slurry tune of Henry Kissinger and George Shultz at the Bohemian Grove complimenting Summers on his piece. Anyway, step on the site, take a look at it. Some interesting statistics. Etsy, the arts and crafts website, I got my desk, my office desk came from a wonderful carpenter in Oregon. Etsy did its IPO, and it's up 86% in the first day of trading. That's quite a pop. New fact this week in the Wall Street Journal, about 82,000 jobs have been added by 454 U.S. companies that completed initial public offerings under the Jobs Act. And so there's no doubt that's one of the parts of the economy that is providing jobs and is providing something healthy going on. So IPOs have not kept up with last year, but let's hope they keep coming. Our hero this week are students protesting Common Core. I hadn't heard about the story. It took place in Mexico. Hundreds of New Mexico high school students just walked out. I hope it happens all over the country. It's exactly what has to happen. It's very ridiculous. I'm going to be talking more about Common Core in the first quarter wrap-up next week. And we've done a wonderful interview with author Anthony Cody, author of the book An Educator and the Oligarch, and wonderful book on Common Core. Ask Catherine. Dear Catherine, in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan described in a speech to the UN how the people of the world would all come together if we were told that there was an alien superpower that we were all being threatened by. Do you think that the powers that be might utilize this approach to tell us about all of the black budget projects they've been involved in to get us to unite in unison behind everything they'll then be telling us to do? I don't see the conditions appropriate to do something like that right now, although certainly the last 10 years of alien movies from Hollywood would certainly lead you to believe that that's the plan. I think the challenge right now is that the U.S. government's institutional credibility is deep, is just very, very low. And I have a hard time imagining how they would pull something like that off. So I think it's unlikely. It would take too much coordination globally between all the governments of the globe. Dear Catherine, I'm an upstate New York resident and wanted to introduce myself and my creative work to you before the anticipated luncheon in New York. And then she describes several videos that she sent. Each is approximately 5 minutes long. I'm a writer, performance artist. I take on topics such as big pharma, predatory banking, even transhumanism. I often use the moniker Some Woman and enjoy bookings at festivals, gallery opens, and prose and poetry readings. The first performance is a dark comedy. Here's a 5-minute piece on the pharmaceutical industry. Here's one on predatory banking, which I absolutely loved, and you can find it up on the website this week. It's really wonderful. I also write a lot of prose and spoken word. My husband and I produced a rock opera, A Wall Street Odyssey. The soundtrack garnered exuberant reviews from Vanity Fair, Chronogram, and Keyboard magazine in spite of our angle of truth-telling. I know my husband also plans to share some of his music videos with you before the subscriber lunch. They have lyrics you might find particularly entertaining, genre, creative rock, pop. But again, only if you have time, etc. And we wanted to let you know we're coming to the gathering. Anyway, the New York event just has an incredible group of people coming. So if you're coming, you will meet our performance artist. And as I said again, the predatory lending one is up on the blog. It's very good. Check it out. Very funny. Someone asked, what are your thoughts on bond funds? I know there are hundreds out there. You can't give specific advice, but can you give a general opinion? We're coming into a turn in the bond market. Nobody knows when, but if interest rates start to rise, it'll be rough on bonds. So here's what you want to understand when you look at bond funds. Clearly, what you care about are credit and performance histories and quality. One way to do that is to look at the Morningstar ratings of a bond fund. Just stick with bond funds that have a 4 and 5-star rating. I don't always agree with Morningstar, but it is one way to keep it simple. And they're fairly good at recognizing funds that have had very good performances in their class. One thing you can do with any bond fund is compare it to the ETF index fund for that particular kind of thing to see how it performs against it. When interest rates rise, what happens is you tend to lose more value the longer the maturity of the bond. So when you look at a bond fund, you want to consider duration. Duration, think of that as essentially the average maturity of all the bonds together. And one way to avoid principal loss if interest rates should rise is to stay with intermediate or short durations. One of the reasons we're concerned about credit issues right now is we run the risk of real liquidity problems in the bond market because there's been such a downsizing of dealers and inventories in that area. And so you want to stick with high quality bonds or funds that keep a fairly high credit so that there is a fair amount of credit quality and you won't have liquidity problems. Be careful not to take currency risk unless you're prepared to take it because you can get fairly wide swings. So I tend to stick, you know, at times like this with bond funds that are operating or denominated in dollars and really don't take currency risk unless you're prepared to take it and understand what you're doing. If you have an active manager who understands what he's doing, it's clear that's what you want to do. So again, I would stick with Morningstar 4 or 5 ratings and with something with sort of the intermediate or shorter durations and very high credit quality. Dear Catherine, I came across this article that I thought was very interesting and wanted to share it with you. The article describes a secret meeting held in Los Angeles in 1991 where music industry executives were told of the plan to privatize their prisons and how they were going to be given ground floor opportunities to invest in the system. Their job in the process, though, would be to make rap music where it's much more violent, thereby corrupting our citizens and sending more of them to prison. I've read that story before. I don't know if it's true. It certainly could be. It certainly fits the facts of what I saw and experienced. And yes, it was a decision coming top down and backed by major force. The scariest thing that I saw was how many people went along with it and thought it was a great way to make money. And essentially, what they were told is this is how things were going to go, and the big money was in, and if they went along, they'd make a lot of money. And everybody was like, oh, this is great. We're going to make a lot of money. Springtime with Hitler. It was pretty scary. So I don't know if that story is true. It could be. It could be false. There's no way to tell. But, you know, if you look at the phenomena described, that's what happened, and that's how the music was engineered to go along. And let's go to the movies. This week I reviewed the third season of House of Cards. I love House of Cards. If you work in Washington, it's always hard to describe to people what it's really like. And I think House of Cards does a very good job. In the third season, Frank Underwood, our conniving, ruthless congressman, played by Kevin Spacey, one of the greatest actors of our time, in my opinion, has now ruthlessly engineered his way from Congress into the U.S. presidency. And one of the more interesting parts of season three is the U.S. president is visited by the Russian president and then travels to Moscow to negotiate with the Russian president, who's as equally ruthless and conniving as he is. Very interesting to watch them go at each other's throat. I find House of Cards to be truly Shakespearean. I've read all of Shakespeare's plays and seen many of them produced. And I really enjoy it. I think Netflix has done an incredible job with this thing. Apparently, they've announced there will be a season four. One of the things that most concerns me is when people tell me their kids or grandkids are going to Washington to work. It's fine, but they need to understand how the city really works and how government really works. So the best thing you can do is sit them down and have them watch cigars so they're prepared for the meat grinder before they get there. One of the things House of Cards does a very nice job of doing is sort of covering the economy at both the micro and macro level and how it dovetails with government and government rules and regulations and money. So it's kind of fun to watch. Finally, I would note that Netflix market cap just passed that of CBS. And it just goes to show that occasionally a media company that really does care about the consumer and treats the consumer right can put the other guys out of business. So good for you, Netflix. Our interview tonight is with Ann Williamson. Ann came and gave us sort of the background on the Ukraine last year in the fourth quarter. It was so successful and we got such positive feedback and requests to get her back that I asked her to come back. We spoke to her. She was in Budapest to get a real update on what's happening in Eastern Europe and what's been happening. It's a great interview and I strongly recommend it to you. I would note that, of course, the Iran deal is not good for Russia. It means ultimately more energy coming into Europe from the Middle East, and that's real competition for Russia. The Iran deal, of course, is only a framework. There are a lot of details to be worked out between now and June, and a lot of people opposing it, so it's far from a done deal. But doing his best to make sure that it didn't become a done deal, we see Russian President Vladimir Putin this week agreeing to sell long-range air defense missile systems to Iran and doing everything he can to bollocks up the relationships. But pretty funny that he jumped in and did that. Frank Underwood would be proud. Anyway, the quote that I used for the Salary Report blog post for Ann's interview was from, it was a Ukraine proverb, "There are many lies, but barely one truth," and what an appropriate description of that whole situation. Okay, events coming up. We have our luncheon at Club 21 in New York on April 25th. I'm headed out to Pennsylvania this weekend, so I'm looking forward to seeing many of you. So far, we have 40 people coming to lunch, private room. It's going to be a great lunch. Richard Dolan joining us to speak from 12 to 4. You'll get all your questions answered. I'm very much looking forward. If you look at who's coming, it's a great group. But we will take up the Sizemore if you want tickets. So just call or email customer service or just click on the link in the invitation that you should have received. We still have the Soleri coin promotion going, and the annual wrap-up book is still available for sale. We'll be making a book as well from the first quarter wrap-up coming up next week. So that's it for this evening. In closing, we've got a great lineup coming up on Soleri Report. Our theme for the first quarter wrap-up next week is Planet Debt, and it's a big one. I've spent a great deal of time, the whole Soleri team has spent a great deal of time researching, making graphs, and really distilling down the 411 on the debt situation this planet. It's fascinating and it's interesting, and I think we've really distilled it down to the essence of. I think you'll find that very, very useful, particularly in combination with the planet equity presentation we did in the annual wrap-up. Then April 30th, Whitley Strieber, the very New York Times bestselling author, joins us for the big picture. I asked him to take a look at our annual wrap-up and then talk to me about what I missed and what I forgot, and he did a great job. Really, really focuses on what's happening environmentally on planet Earth. Fascinating discussion with Whitley. And then to top it off, on the first week of May, the future of NATO and the pivot to Asia with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. We've had a lot of demand to get him back. It was an unbelievable conversation. I've already recorded it. He's on his way to Italy to teach on national security issues. And so I grabbed him before he went. And it's an unbelievable conversation about everything happening with the U.S. position globally, the national security issues, the hubris of American leaders. One of the best strategic conversations, guys, really brilliant and very capable. And sees what's happening very clearly. So I can't wait for you to hear all three of these. It's a wonderful lineup. So ladies and gentlemen, until the first quarter wrap up on April 23rd next week, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Good night and good luck.